come up on Taiwan.
I'm in Studio B, sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And I'm in Studio B, sitting across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
And this is Words on a Wire.
Welcome to another edition of our show.
Today we have poet Carmen Jimenez Smith, who is going to talk to us about her new book and other fun things.
And she's also going to read a poem from one of her books.
Yes, she's going to read a poem, Photo of a Girl on a Beach. And I love that poem.
And our poetic license comes from?
My very good friend Amit Ghosh. He's going to talk about the struggle of being a writer. Because, you know, a lot of people do struggle with being a writer. It's a tough, tough field these days.
We all struggle.
Yeah, even those, you know, who are established and everyone thinks have great lives. And, you know, the fact is, if you saw their interiors, man, they're like, ah, it's so tough.
So, Daniel, what are you reading?
Well, I was reading Carmen Jimenez Smith's books to prepare for this interview, and I'm really liking her poetry. I think she's got a beautiful sound, just like ride on the language with her, right? You don't search for meaning, you just ride on the language, and I find her work incredibly, incredibly beautiful.
Well, last night I couldn't sleep very well, and I wanted to just pick something up to read.
Mm-hmm.
And I had read this book already, and it's a book of essays, and it's so beautiful. Gerald Stern's What I Can't Bear Losing.
No way. I'm reading that right now, too.
It's just wonderful.
That is weird because that's what I was going to answer. I just finished that poem called Paris. He lives in that tenement apartment with the wife of the owner who he kind of has an affair with. It's a fantastic collection of essays.
It's so beautifully written. I feel as if he's so honest about – not only is he honest about his life and mm-hmm. what he's lived, and he has such a good memory. But he's so careful in the wording. It just blows me away. Mm-hmm. I read the sentence
he's
again.
Definitely a poet.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And you know what's really interesting about that book? He's writing it as an old man, and he's writing about being a young man. And so oftentimes he has to question his own memory. And it's as he's questioning his memory that he comes out of the literal landscape of the narrative and allows it to get a little bit blurry. And it's that space, that non-physical space where he's trying to get memory, that a lot of the beauty and the tension comes
through. So we'll just have to have him on our show.
Absolutely.
He's a colleague of Philip Levine.
Yeah.
And a
yeah.
friend.
All we got to do is call up Phil. I got his number. I'll call him right now.
Okay.
Stick around and we'll talk to Carmen Jimenez Smith.
Stay tuned.
Carmen Jimenez Smith is author of a memoir, Bring Down the Little Birds, which recently won the American Book Award. I was there at the ceremony last fall in Berkeley, and she was fantastic. She has three poetry collections, Goodbye Flicker, which just won the Juniper Prize for Poetry and comes out this month, The City She Was, and Odalisque in Pieces. She also has three poetry chapbooks and has co-edited a fiction anthology, My Mother, She Killed Me, My Father, He Ate Me, which came out with Penguin in 2010. Formerly a teaching writing fellow at the Iowa Writers Workshop, she now teaches in the creative writing program at New Mexico State University and Ashland University. She also serves as editor-in-chief of the literary journal Puerto del Sol and the publisher of Naomi Press. She lives with her husband, the writer Evan Lavender Smith, and their two children in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Carmen Jimenez Smith, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
You know, your first full-length book came out in 2009, I believe,
uh-huh.
Which was 3 years ago. And since then, you have come out with three more, won some major national awards, and on top of that, you run a publishing company, edit a major literary journal, teach classes at the university, and you have two children. How do you do it?
Or, better put, when do you sleep? When do you sleep?
I don't sleep. I don't sleep much. But I don't do any of this alone. I mean, the magazine is really run by the graduate students here, and I'm just kind of a facilitator, and you know, because I've been doing it for a while. So I just sort of point them in the right direction, and they do the rest. And so I guess I am smart enough to surround myself with really gifted and smart and hardworking people. So it looks like I'm doing a lot of things. And my husband is also really supportive, and And I think that helps, too. So I'm very much like Tom Sawyer painting his fence, you know, saying, oh, you should come. This is a lot of fun. Come paint this fence with me. I think that's part of my secret.
And when do you find time to write? I know you have two children.
I write late at night. Once the kids go to bed around 8 or 8:30, and that's a good thing. Having an early bedtime is a good thing. But then I write, and I write in, you know, well into the night. I'm starting to write more prose now. And that's been more challenging, finding the time, you know, because prose, as you know, requires a kind of chunks of time that poetry sometimes doesn't. Mm-hmm. So that's been more challenging, and I'm not producing prose as quickly as I'd like, but it's happening really late at night.
Oh, you know, that kind of makes me wonder, in your memoir, Bring Down the Little Birds, I love that title, I think it's beautiful, it's kind of written in fragments.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how much the writing process itself, having to tend to the children, having to tend to all these other things that you're doing, is responsible for the form of that book.
Well, that definitely, I mean, I wanted to write a lyric essay, and that was part of it. But part of the reason I was so attracted to the form was exactly that, that if I thought of something I wanted to write, it had to be something that I could remember because I was holding a baby or having to do 5 million things at once.
It
had to be something I could jot down really quickly.
Right.
And so I was carrying around notebooks, you know, all over the place. And if I would think of something, I would write it down, and then I would bring all of it together. Things that I wrote would be generative, and I would write more little things to sort of connect it. So the form is actually was super conducive to my life, and it still continues to be. I continue to write in that form. I like that form a lot. I like the lyric essay a lot.
One critic writes, Carmen Jimenez-Smith elevates, this is about your memoir, Carmen Jimenez-Smith elevates the motherhood memoir to pure poetry. Who are we? Beyond somebody's mother and somebody's daughter. Bring Down the Little Birds dives into all the rich and irritating questions with heart, guts, and humor. Makes me wonder, with your busy life, do you sometimes get a rhythm in your head and you keep that rhythm until you have time to sit down and write it?
Absolutely, yeah. And I have a terrible memory, so it's kind of a struggle. But yeah, when I'm working on something, it's in my head. It's sort of in the backdrop of my thinking all day long. So I'm sort of processing and working it out. And then when I get a chance, I'll start working on it. So I'm always sort of processing and thinking about it. And, of course, the great thing about being a teacher is you can ask a lot of those questions and bring a lot of those curiosities into the classroom and have your class sort of function as a laboratory where you can kind of work these ideas out. So when I'm working on something, it becomes part of my life, and that's really helpful, the ability to be able to do that.
I don't believe that any poet / writer really does have a terrible memory, because I think that's really what we bring to our work, memory.
Sure.
Yeah, but I wanted to ask, take a step backward. When did you know that you were going to become a poet and a writer?
That's a good question. I always wanted to be a teacher. I knew that ever since I was, you know, 4 years old, I wanted to be a teacher. And so then as I got farther along, I realized I loved to read, and I loved talking about reading and talking about books. And it wasn't until I was in high school that I thought, I had a wonderful high school teacher who was a poet himself and taught poetry, and he taught us the beat poets, and his taste was super eclectic. And so that's when I realized that poetry was something that contemporary people still did. But it wasn't really until college that I started taking creative writing classes and actually was writing that I started thinking I could both be a teacher and a writer. And when I was in college, I wanted to be a fiction writer, but I was kind of terrible at it. And poetry was a little bit easier for me to do. And so I wrote more poetry, and I applied to grad school for poetry, and that kind of set me on my course. But it really is the wonderful teachers I had that introduced me to the possibility that I could be a writer. I didn't even think that that was something that I could do. I thought I would just be a teacher. And so it wasn't until, you know, high school and college that I really started thinking about being a writer.
How do you put the two together? Because, I mean, I also love to teach, and I'm a writer, I'm a poet, I'm a fiction writer as well. But I think of them as really separate arts. How do you put the two together?
Well, part of when you teach creative writing or when you're trying to teach people to love to read and to think about what they're reading, I think there's a little bit of the proselytizer, you know, like the revivalist in you, you know. And so I think being passionate about writing and loving to write is important because of I know how transformed I've been by everything that I've read and how moved and how much I've learned by reading and in turn by writing. And so bringing that same energy that I bring, you know, you have to be enthusiastic about writing because revision is tough and there's a lot of writing that's really arduous and plodding and boring and difficult. But what offsets that is your belief in the joy that you can get from it and knowing what's on the other side of that. And so I have to remind them of that, and I think that being a writer helps that, to be able to say, this is what it feels like, this is what can happen, this is what you can discover about the world and about yourself. I think that they do inform one another. And the other thing is I have a lot of questions about writing that I deal with in the classroom, questions that I bring to them about craft that we have conversations about, and that's really helpful. And also, when writing is ineffable, it's hard sometimes to access solutions to your problems. But when you're a teacher, part of your job is making the ineffable tangible. And so constantly having to do that makes process much easier for me because I'm able to articulate the kinds of issues that I'm facing and then the kinds of solutions that are possible.
One of my favorite quotes is from Robert Frost. A writer should either farm or else cheat their employer. But as a teacher of creative writing, we all teach in an MFA program, we all teach creative writing, it's very easy to live a non-fragmented life because, like you say, we bring those questions to our students and the obsessions that we have are the books that we assign and the discussions that we have in class. But then there's other parts of our lives that we have to negotiate the fragmentation, somehow bringing those into our poetry, bringing those into our language, bringing those into our metaphorical landscape. And I'm wondering how you negotiate rhythm of the voice of your children with, do you incorporate that into your poetry, the voice of your children, or how you talk to them, or the rhythms that go on around the house?
You know, my son is starting to discover the writer in him. And so
no way.
Just this week, actually, we were writing poems together, and he was writing an acrostic. And I just kind of picked up on the energy of, like, how an acrostic is informed by that first letter and how it kind of creates. He's a super perfectionist, so I know he potentially could be a poet, which is a mother's, you know, ambivalent dream.
Yeah.
And so I found myself kind of picking up on that, on the way those lines were working really independent from one another because of the energy from that first letter. And then, you know, they say interesting things and see the world in interesting ways. But I think more importantly, like the way they ask about the world and the way that I have to sort of conjure up answers to explain difficult things gives me a chance to think about these other ways that the world can be defined, which is important.
We're talking to Carmen Jimenez-Smith, whose most recent book just won the Juniper Prize for Poetry. It's called Goodbye Flicker. You wrote in an article, you wrote that you write not so much to communicate with others, but to communicate with yourself. This far into your career as a writer, and it's really not very far, you have a long way to go. What do you find you're saying to yourself? What message is imperative to you?
Well, I think right now I'm thinking a lot about where I come from and who my parents were, and especially my mom, who has Alzheimer's. And as I'm watching her sort of struggle very mightily with being in the world and losing the tethers that connect her to the everyday and to us, I find myself really, you know, looking around and trying to frantically define what ties me to the world and also to her and to my father. So, you know, I think when you're young, and I had a teacher who said, Elmaz Abinader, who was my teacher at San Jose State, she teaches at Mills College, she said something like, you know, you spent the first 7 years of your writing career, you know, writing about your parents. But but I think that I'm going to spend the rest of my life because there are people who are, you know, obviously who were the center of my universe for a really, really long time in a very insular family. and I have a lot of questions about them coming to this country. Things that I take for granted about being in this country was for them.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background? I don't think everybody knows it. We're talking to Carmen Jimenez-Smith.
Sure. My parents are South American immigrants. They came from, they were both living in Peru. My mother is born in Peru. My father was born in Argentina, but he lived in Peru from the time he was an adolescent. Mm. And they kind of came on a lark. They came on vacation and they decided to stay with a bunch of friends. It was the 60s. So they stayed in New York and that's where I was born. And, you know, they kind of moved around a great deal. We moved around a lot. My father had lots of different kinds of jobs and lots of different kinds of employment situations. So we moved around a lot, but we were very, very close. My grandmother lived with us, so it was a very, like, very insular world, my family. You know, we socialized with people from our cultural background. We socialized with one another. There weren't that many friends from the outside until I got a little bit older. And, I mean, to me, like, interestingly enough, as I've gotten older, that's kind of dissolved, like the sense of that has dissolved, and that's been really interesting, the way that I've kind of constructed a new world for myself that's slightly insular but has a lot to do with the arts and with writing and all these communities that I create, you know, with the press and with the magazine and with teaching. They're still fairly insular. But, yeah, my mother lives in California and my father lives in Florida.
It's really interesting how you're really talking about how your parents came to this to the United States and reinvented themselves.
Yep.
And it's not maybe an accident that you're a writer, because what we do is we're always reinventing ourselves or inventing other worlds or other peoples and other voices and all of that. I did have another question. It had to do with teaching. You know, you seem to be, like, very enthusiastic about teaching. And I was just wondering, do you just teach what you love, or do sometimes do you teach the things that you don't love? Sometimes do you teach writers or a book that you really don't like, but there's a reason that you chose it, and it's not about you or your own tastes, but it becomes a teachable moment and not about just the things that you love?
Yeah. Absolutely. And in fact, I mean, I think one of the other great things about being a teacher is I can't hate things. You know what I mean? Because I'm not a good teacher if I can't read widely and embrace things widely and see things that, you know, my students love all kinds of different things and I have to understand them. And hating something makes it really hard to understand it. So I have to be a really, really open reader and, you know, recognize. And the other thing is, the other advantage of being a really open reader is that there's always something you can learn from somebody else, even somebody that you struggle reading.
T.S. Eliot, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, there's always something there that can go in the toolbox. And I know that all of the poets that I really admire are very, very open, wide readers. So I have absolutely taught books that I've struggled with, that I have questions about, because what better place to bring it to than the classroom, where there are all of these different voices that help teach the book to me as we're having a conversation.
You know, it reminds me of a Talmudic saying, wise is the person, well, wise is the man, but we can change the language, wise is the person who can learn from everyone. Oftentimes it seems that your poetry is led more by sound and music than it is by meaning, that you're completely willing to let the sound control the meaning. And I'm wondering if your relationship with the English language, having come later, because I know you started understanding Spanish first, has allowed you to hear English in a way that maybe a non-native speaker or a native speaker would not have been able to.
Absolutely. When I was in graduate school, one of my colleagues told me that my poetry sounded like it was in translation. And to me, often when I'm working out what a poem needs to do, I can hear what it needs to do before I can know what it needs to do. So I know that it needs a certain number of phrases or maybe one more sentence, and I know about how many sounds that sentence has to have before I actually know what's in that sentence. So, and I think it is like learning English to me was like breaking a code, and I still feel that way, that it's the words have something inside of them that needs to be broken open by syntax. And so I'm absolutely driven by sound. And sometimes that's problematic. I have lots of drafts of poems that make no sense at all, but they sound really pretty. And so what I have to do is to work them towards making sense and being cohesive.
Thank you so much, Carmen, for joining us. We're talking to Carmen Jimenez-Smith, whose new book, and she comes out with one every once or twice a year, is called Goodbye Flicker, and it's the winner of the Juniper Prize for Poetry. One of my favorite poems is Photo of a Girl on a Beach, and it's from your first collection, Odalisque in Pieces. Would you be willing to read that for our poem of the day?
Absolutely, absolutely. Photo of a Girl on a Beach. Once, when I was harmless and didn't know any better, a mirror to the front of me and an ocean behind, I lay wedged in the middle of daylight, paper doll thin, dreaming. Then I vanished. I gave the day a fingerprint, then forgot. I sat naked on a towel on a hot June Monday. The sun etched the inside of my eyelids while a boy dozed at my side. The smell of all oceans was around us, steamy salt, shell, and sweat, but I reached for the distant one. A tide rose while I slept, and soon I was alone. Try being a figure in memory. It's hollow there. For truth's sake, I'll say she was on a beach, and her eyes were closed. She was bare in the sand, long, and the hour took her bit by bit.
That was Carmen Jimenez-Smith reading the poem of the week.
Thank you, Carmen, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
On today's Poetic License, we have a word from Amit Ghosh. Amit Ghosh came to El Paso in 1997 to study in the MFA bilingual program at the University of Texas at El Paso. He was a student here for 3 years. As a matter of fact, I directed his thesis. He decided to stay because he fell in love with El Paso. And he started a literary magazine called Border Senses, which is an independent literary magazine about border issues and features border writers. He started that literary magazine in 2000. It has been a great success, and he has contributed greatly to El Paso's literary scene.
I decided to write something about trying to be a writer, which I struggle with. The title of this piece is An Odd Dilemma, How to Be a Writer or Not. Sometimes I wonder what makes me continue to persevere to be a lekhok in Bengali or a writer. That too in English, a language that someone who doesn't know me and my Indian roots may perceive as non-native. I grew up in post-independent multilingual India, where in spite of the existence of many languages, 15 official plus others, that have been spoken for centuries, the language of the last colonialists, English, is surely the language of communication and business amongst the citizens, almost all of whom speak some other language natively. I, like millions of others, struggle to come to terms to what language to use for communication, at business, with family, and in love. And then I've been hearing it for some time. All those Indian guys at call centers, programming shops, very smart. After all, I work in the technology field and one had to be part of the system. How hard can it be? I've tried and failed at this simple act of following along the tried and proven path designed to make life successful. Good Indian boys back in my youth were expected to learn medicine or technology, be employed, marry into proper class and caste, and improve the family value chain. It's a fairly easy formula, or supposed to be, but for me, somewhere the simplicity broke down. I'd acquired many of the elements of the toolkit, college degrees in engineering, reasonable social skills, and decent employment, although a job in the academic world is always seen as an alternative to bright young careerists and prospective brides and in-laws. But a serious challenge to implementing life's algorithm being faithfully replicated came in the shape of deep calling for literature, the same way I would surmise one answers to the call of priesthood. A constant nagging thought of wanting to read and write, something I hated as a child, more like a vocation and far more than a hobby. I like technology, but I love literature, and that has been my Achilles heel, or the source of inspiration, whichever way one wants to look at it. I can trace this love of literature to reading fairy tale stories in Thakurmar Juli in my mother tongue, Bengali, as a child, and later Shelley, Keats, Dickens, and Shakespeare in middle and high school. but this love remained nascent because in my youth, we were measured in our prowess in mathematics and the sciences, permutations and combinations, calculus, vectors and kinetics. But on occasion, I stole time admiring poetic words on pages, evoking images of quiet English countrysides in the middle of the bustle of busy Calcutta. Nobel laureate Rabindranath's poems and Yeats' writings gave me solace from the relentless grindings of physics and math problems. But as often the journey to be an engineer, and all the literature I enjoyed, I didn't take the time to explore what I liked and fell in the trap of what I was expected to do. Frankly, it is impossible to judge today whether I would have pursued a degree in art, something my world then would have thought of as an act of suicide, especially for a boy who could hack the math and its toils. A decade after I moved to the US to pursue graduate studies in engineering, I rekindled my love of literature quite by accident. I was working in Boston and suddenly found myself in a situation quite unfamiliar to me. It was this combination of having time because I was laid off from work and accentuated by a pensive mood acquired from a lost love that always brings a level of uncertainty. I remember my first attempts at delving into this world of imagination, a strange space without clearly measured boundaries and an absence of singularity of responses unfamiliar in my technology world. After the initial challenge, I could see in my mind's eye characters acting, scenes forming and dissolving, and I became the recorder of an imaginary world that I never knew existed around me. It was the beginning of my long journey to being a writer, if not in proven publication, at least in temperament. I began to learn that one has to give him or her permission to write, to explore, to spot the light on things in a way that may make it uncomfortable. Writers have to power themselves and have the tenacity to get over issues of self-loathing and self-esteem. It was to endeavor to not repeat the obvious, but redeem ideas in a refreshing way. I've been living for several decades in the US now, once an unfamiliar land full of strangers who have now become my family in a place that has become my home. Just like I faced in Boston, I'm at another crossroads in El Paso, right on the US-Mexico border. My struggle to be a writer is as much a story of my evolving American identity, taking binational values of the region and forging them into my Indian background, which acts as a yoke and a pillar, centers me, urges me forward, and restrains me back. Time will tell whether I have learned something, a thing or two, about the addiction of reading and writing. It's important to just write and not worry about being called a writer. Conviction and work will find an audience. Paraphrasing Wordsworth, I can say that art, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder.
That was Amit Ghosh with this week's Poetic License. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of Words on a Wire.
And we'd like to thank our guest, Carmen Jimenez-Smith. And don't forget, you can follow us now on Twitter. Subscribe to us on iTunes. You can subscribe to our shows on Podomatic. And you can listen to every show we've ever done, ever, ever, ever. And we'd like to thank our producer, Norma Martinez. She is responsible for giving shape to this show. And without her, we would just sound like a bunch of weirdos standing around talking literature, which I guess we do anyway, right? I guess we are a bunch of weirdos.
So hats off to our producer, Norma Martinez.
Next week, we're not going to be on the air because there's going to be a fun drive. Please make sure you listen in and give to KTEP so we can keep our show on the air. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alire Sainz.
And don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circle.